This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Glad to have you along on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about adaptable plants today, plants that can thrive even when the weather changes. Our guest is Liz Fremont. She is a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. Have you lost plants because of changing weather patterns, or are you looking for suggestions for plants that are more adaptable? Be part of the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And of course, you can send an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Liz, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back on.
You bet. Always a pleasure when I get to talk with you. I'm sure our listeners feel the same way. So, Liz, what are the characteristics of an adaptable plant?
It's all right there in the two words, adaptable plant. But you know, when we think about adaptable, you know, often we'll think, oh, okay, well, it will tolerate, or it will be okay. What we're looking for as gardeners and homeowners are plants that do better than just okay. And so for me, adaptable plants means that you can pop them in, and even if we didn't have climate changes going on, that they could adjust to whatever the environment or whatever the human factor throws at them and do okay, and thrive and not get sick, you know, because sometimes a plant will tolerate conditions, but it weakens them. And as soon as you weaken, you're inviting in pathogens or insect damage. And that's not where we want to put our plants. We don't want to put them in a weakened state. So when I talk about adaptable, it's they're going to forgive us and they're going to do well. They're going to adapt okay and do well, not just, you know,
right,
mumble and bumble along.
Oh, that's the worst, especially with the amount of money you invest in a plant.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it can get very expensive if you have to replace it a lot. And I know a lot of us, you know, we really, really want that plant because it's beautiful or what have you. But there are usually some options that are similar to plants that we're, you know, we like, right?
Absolutely. And even just choosing a replacement plant. So for years, I want to back that up for a sec. For years, we have looked at rain gardens as adaptable plants. And, you know, when you look at the changes in the environment, that has given us some impetus to look not just at those areas that we know are going to have rain issues, that are going to collect water, and we put plants in that are going to manage and just love that inconsistent moisture or that flooding or the drought or whatever in different times. We need to look at our entire yards and say, okay, when you put a tree in, you're putting a tree in for your kids and your grandkids. You're not always putting that tree in and it's just going to be for 15 years. So when you look at that, you have to say, okay, what potentially in my yard has given me a clue that my plants are going to have to figure out what to do with what we throw at them? So if you're seeing some areas of flooding in your yard now, expect that's going to get a little bit worse. So you want to look for trees as, you know, the structure plants. You want to look for trees that are going to say, okay, throw some water at me, I'll be all right. I'm fine with that. I can do that. That's not a big deal. And that's kind of what we, you know, when I look at adaptable plants, and oftentimes you'll hear me call them the hack and whack plants because you can do anything to them and they still are beautiful, you know, and they grow and they thrive. And so when we're looking at stuff, let's just pick a couple. You know, for trees in the yard, there are big trees, little trees that will do really well when you throw things at them. And I was having a tree chat with Chad Johnson of Johnson Nurseries the other day, and I asked him what his favorite evergreen was that you know, what if somebody dumps a truckload of water on it? What is going to happen? You know, will it do beautiful? And he said there are two junipers that he likes. So evergreens, that's a little tough to find something that's going to tolerate some flooding or some dry. Now, junipers, typically when it gets super, super dry and long periods of drought, you'll see some needle drop or some needle, you know, desiccation. But water is often, too much water is often the bane of their existence. So he recommended Star Power and Troutman as plants that he has tested with obscene amounts of water periodically throughout the year, and they do beautifully. So that's one of them. The Thuja, and he said actually the junipers he likes better for that than the Thuja, that they do better. So when you're looking at Thuja, which is the arborvita, for us around here with anybody who's got deer pressures, it's the placata, that does really well. The deer have adapted to eating that in some areas, i.e. my yard. but they do resist that in some other areas. So those are two evergreens that will tolerate that water that shows up periodically. When we're looking at other trees, the deciduous oaks, you know, we've got swamp oak, and then there are some crosses that do really well, and they don't care what kind of conditions you throw at them. Some of the smaller trees, now I have multiples in my yard, but the Chionanthus virginicus, not the Chinese version, which is a little, that's reticulus, I think, reticulata, that can be a little invasive. The native is not. Now, there has been some talk that potentially ash borer will move into that. I have not experienced that in my own yard where I have multiples. And I have them in areas that get really weird conditions, too hot, too dry, shady, sunny, you name it, and they're fine. Mm-hmm. They're fine. They're just very easy.
And you did share a list with us, which I will put up on our website later this afternoon, I think. So don't even try to write these down because.
Yeah, no, don't. Because I gave the scientific spellings on those so you get the exact ones we're talking about.
Yes.
So don't try and write them down.
No. So just basically, you know, copy and paste and put it in your search engine and that one will come up for you. So you'll know what you're looking for, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now, there are some, you know, like magnolia. I have magnolia down on the list as just magnolia. Pick and choose for your conditions because there are some that are a little more drought tolerant. So if you have a yard that you think, you know, if you experienced drought issues last year, don't worry, you'll experience them again this year if you were missing it. So if you have plants that you know need to go into those types of areas, you can choose from a wider range of what is available. And oftentimes people don't take magnolia as seriously as they should around here as a quality plant, most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, they're beautiful, even when the blooms are gone. But we still tend to think of magnolias as a southern tree, don't we?
We do. And, you know, we have to get past and as I age, it gets more important. Stop thinking about what happened when I was young because the environment changes.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing changing conditions, zonal change, you know, all of that. And so for the last, gazillion years, when I go down south to see friends and or clients, I bring plants back and I trial them. I have killed so many plants figuring out what does and doesn't work. And, you know, for everybody out there who's gardening, that's okay, other than it hits the checkbook.
In that
case, you know, it's not quite as pleasant. But when you're trying to figure out what does work from zones outside of where you live, oftentimes you can be surprised. One of the biggest surprises for me in my yard was calycanthus, which is a Carolina sweet shrub. And I've had that in my yard for about 18 years, 20 years. And I started bringing cultivars up from Georgia that should not have survived at all. And they've done beautifully. And when you're down in their range, their kind of native range, and they're native plants for us that you can see them on everything from bottomlands to uplands. And so if you can see those growing in a native area and they're surviving under conditions that are either too much or too little, you know you'll probably be okay.
Yeah, that's definitely adaptable, for sure. Speaking of native plants, that's a good place to start, isn't it, for adaptable plants?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I don't discount the non-natives, but having a beautiful, beautiful environment that we do in Wisconsin, we have got a lot of beautiful plants to choose from. And, you know, we often forget that things like hibiscus are native for us. And so when we're looking at, you know, people can take a look at the plant list, but as we kind of go down and look through some of these natives that will do really well under whatever conditions we throw at them, you know, there's things that will surprise people. The aronia, baptisia, there's so many wonderful, wonderful things. Buttonbush, which is a cephalanthus, that is a beautifully adaptable shrub that can go in standing water or very well drained. I have it in everything from shade to sun. And it just does really, really well. In other condition, you know, if it's got plenty of moisture and the right amount of sun, it will be kind of a compact, heavily branched shrub. When you put it into conditions that are not, quote unquote, ideal, according to a book, then it will be a little bit more open. The branches will reach out, but it's still a beautiful shrub. And it is a hack and whack. You can cut it back very hard every year, and it will come back just beautifully, not as quickly as a hydrangea, but it will sprout and get nice 6-8 foot growth on it in 1 year if you cut it back. So, and, you know, there are things like that where the natural adaptability is wonderful, and we just have to realize that they're out there and we need to figure out how to find them.
Sure. Vern called to suggest the Trees book in the Time Life Encyclopedia of Gardening, which was published back in 1972. He says the book says that white oaks don't survive where there is a lot of water.
If that book says that, I don't know what the research is out there between 1970 and now. That's an awful lot of research.
Yeah.
But the swamp oak is, I mean, it's in the name, is it not?
Yep.
And so everything within that category of trees, if there is a difference within that species and it's a named cultivar, and it says it will tolerate the water, that's what it does.
Okay.
And that's the research out there. And it's like you and me. You may tolerate the heat better than I do. We're still humans.
Right.
And it's the same thing with plants. And it really, a lot depends on, and you'll hear this from Dr. Joel, and you'll hear it from other people, other specialists, that, you know, it depends on where the plants come from also. What is the provenance of a strain? And will it tolerate, will it not tolerate? So now we're getting into the weeds, into the deep weeds. Do we want to go there? Probably not. Let's talk about fun, pretty stuff, right?
Okay. Well, let's take a break first. Our guest is Liz Fremont. She's a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can always send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Stay with us today. Coming up in the last half hour, we'll revisit a conversation that Larry had with a UW River Falls professor about the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. Right now, let's go to the phones, Liz. We've got Steve in Oshkosh who has a question for you. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi. I have heard many times that global greenhouse gas emissions are continuing to increase, still continuing to increase at an exponential rate. Is that still true?
Oh, gosh, you're asking me a question I don't have an answer to. I'm going to guess that would be more of the science the weather people that Larry has on periodically. But we have not, as a civilization, done enough to bring that down. So my guess is going to be, yeah, it probably is increasing. What it is, that, again, question for somebody with a little bit more experience and knowledge in that area.
Yeah, that's right. And I think probably the weather guys are probably a good one to talk to about that. They're on the last Monday of the month if you want to catch them. Let's go to Robert in Madison next. Go right ahead.
Hello. I have some rose bushes that don't seem to grow on the south side of my property. pH is great on the soil. I'm wondering if I don't have enough drainage.
Do you dig down at all to the roots to see what the soil around those roots is like?
Oh, okay. I can do that.
Yeah, I would. What kind of roses are there? Are they, first of all?
Oh, I'm not sure. We've tried so many different varieties and brand names and, you know, things of that nature.
Okay. Are they shrub roses, tea roses, floribundas?
I think they're shrub roses.
Okay. Shrub roses, if you find one that loves your site, then you're golden, of course, but you're still searching. What I would suggest is possibly hitting the Rose Society pages. They have recommendations for some that will do well. A few that come to mind for a white, there is a Double Day Cubert that is a fantastic white. There's also a Hansa Rose, H-A-N-S-A, that is a pink. The Double Day Cubert is a beautiful, beautiful white, very clear, very healthy. Hansa is the same way. Those are decent shrub roses that should give you not a whole lot of problem. And with shrub roses that are, excuse me, that are hardy for this area, you really don't have to do much at all if they're planted early in the season. If you wait until later in the season for planting roses, then after the ground freezes solid, I recommend a good heavy mulch, like a lot, 6 inches over the root zone, but always wait until after hard freeze, because otherwise you invite bed and breakfast rodents into the mulch. And so you want to wait until hard freeze, so they've already found their winter homes. And then you take that off in the spring. And just, you know, for a hardy rose, that's really all you need to do is 1 year of that so that those roots have a chance to really establish well. Too much moisture on roses is not a good thing, although there are some that are a little bit more tolerant. It's, if you have a wet area, it's not what I would call a super adaptable plant. But if it's just choosing the site, choose well-drained, good soil. You want a decent fertilizer on that, and just go and get a rose fertilizer. That's really what you should put on it. But other than that, if it's a hardy plant and it's well-drained, healthy soil, you should be fine.
Okay, good luck, Robert. And just stick around and listen to the last half hour, because we're going to be talking about even more roses and options. So that maybe will help you out too.
Excellent.
Yeah. So Sherry in Chilton, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hi. You don't have to sell me on magnolias. I love them. And I have a wedding ring magnolia that blooms in early May. And we always get a late frost that knocks all the blooms off before they're really done. But I was in Gurnee, Illinois, and saw a magnolia that was blooming in late August or early September. And I wondered if you knew what variety.
I don't off the top of my head. But, you know, it's funny because I was thinking about that just the other day, thinking,
Oops,
I will dig that out. and
you cut out there for a second. So if you want to go back to what you were thinking about.
I was thinking about the late blooming magnolia myself, and I want one for my yard. And so what I will do is I will find that cultivar name, unless one of the listeners has got it on the top of their head, and I will send it to Jill so that she can post it up with the list.
Okay, that sounds like a great idea because I may want one myself. So thank you, Sherry. I really appreciate that.
They're absolutely beautiful. And I saw one maybe 3-4 years ago at Ebert's in Exonia. Mm. They had one in their tree area. I don't know if that's something that they carry regularly or not, but did happen to see it when I was wandering through and thought I should buy that, and then I didn't. There you go.
Well, that happens to be extremely close to my house and very, very easy for me to check out, so I may have to do that. I planted a yellow blooming magnolia. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fell in love with it, and for some reason last year it just died and all the leaves fell off. So I am really not too confident that it's coming back this year. So I may have to replace it. So,
well, one thing to look for when you're buying a magnolia, and this is across the board for a plant that you want to put in your yard, own root. And so if you can find own root plants, then that is perfect, because a lot of them will actually be grafted, and they'll be grafted onto heavy, you know, really and really wonderfully growing rootstock so that the top has a chance to do whatever it's going to do. We have beautiful magnolias that are own root. So if they die back without taking the root out, like in my yard, I've got a magnolia that is maybe about a foot high, and it's 8 years old because the deer keep eating it off. and yet it keeps coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's going to, if they ever leave it alone and stop tearing my fencing down, that thing will be exactly what I bought, because it's an own root magnolia.
Nice.
So we have had breeders in this state who have been doing wonderful work on own root magnolias. So that's what you want to look for with something like that. And with a yellow flowering, it may be own root. Butterflies, they did not graft later on in the production. So you may actually, maybe okay. I'm a wait and see.
Yeah, me too.
Especially because we do invest a lot in our plants, that if there is a chance that it will come back, I will patiently wait and take my tea out there and watch it every morning.
Yes, I have so many that the rabbits just decimated. And then the next spring, there they are coming up nice and full again. So you never know.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you, Sherry. So we were talking about shrubs. What are some more of the ones that you would recommend for adaptability?
Well, yeah, I have to say that there are a couple non-natives, and, you know, don't get excited, people. I love natives and non-natives, but there's one that I mention frequently, and there is a really good reason for it, and it's an Abelia mosinensis, and it is from Europe. It is the most fragrant shrub in the spring garden. And it is one that flowers on old wood, so you prune it right after it flowers to keep it under control. Right now, one of them in my yard, I'm growing to see exactly how big can I get this. And it's at about 9 feet right now. But if you clip it back hard after it flowers, it stays within about the 3 to 4 or 5 foot range, but it has beautiful arching branches. It has clusters of flowers that look, they're reminiscent of a viburnum bloom. And this is such a low care shrub that you don't have to do a darn thing to it, other than if you want to control the height and width, that you can prune it out a bit. I do know that Jung had some in their catalog last year, and they're even starting to come out with some selection/cultivars of this, and it is well worth shrub. It spreads out.
Okay. Oh, we just lost you again. I don't know what's going on with our connection today, but we're getting some dropouts. So,
No.
Yeah. Maybe when next break we can recall, and maybe that will help. I'm really not sure, but I looked up that the shrub you're talking about, Abelia, and it's called Sweet Emotion, I believe is the.
That might be the cultivar.
And it's and beautiful, beautiful.
It's such an easy shrub to grow. And that one has been super adaptable. It started out in full sun. It's gone to almost like 3/4 shade at this point, and it has not missed a beat.
Nice. Yeah, I love the way it looks. It's got that kind of weeping feeling to it, like a bridal veil or something like that. So,
yeah, really pretty arching branches.
Yeah.
The other shrub that the non-native that I like that looks horrible in a container, no one wants to buy it because it looks disgusting in a container, is Colquitzia, Colquitzia Dreamcatcher. And Colquitzia Pink Cloud has been out there for a number of years, and they're kind of rougher, coarser-looking shrubs, but the flower in the spring is fantastic. I like Dreamcatcher because it is a beautiful orange-pink leaf color when it comes out. It's got a little bit of red along the outside edge, yellowy, lime green. It's got all of this stuff going on. The flowers are pink, and they're tubular. They are absolutely wonderful. Not a fragrant shrub, but it is really, really a very pretty shrub. Another one that after it flowers, you can pack it back to keep it under control. That's another one. I've got two or three of them in the yard. We'll see what survived this winter. And one of them easily, when I left it alone, got up to 8 feet, but cut it back. And in a couple of years, it comes back just beautifully. And it also has a somewhat vase shape to it. It's more of, I wouldn't put it next to the front door. I would put it out in the yard, but the leaf color stays really nice and vibrant. And I've got one in full sun and one in almost complete shade. Gets a little bit of morning light, and the color is fantastic on them. The flowering is fantastic. It's, again, one of those where you can move it around, you can play with it, you can not water it ever, and it does beautifully.
I love those. And it's beautiful. Again, I looked it up, and it's Colquitzia. With a K.
Yeah. And again, if you see that in a container at a garden center or whatever, you'd look at it and go, oh my God, is that on sale? because it is not a good container plant. It's a great in the ground plant, but it doesn't look good in the container. Don't let that fool you. It's an absolutely fantastic shrub. Again, a non-native, and we have so many beautiful natives out there that at least gives you a couple.
Sure.
Of non. Yep.
Yeah, and again, we'll have this list up that Liz gave us this afternoon at some point on our website. So that's WPR.org/Larry, and go to today's show and you will see a link there. So you can get these all for yourself. And let's talk about some perennials. My favorite. I love perennials.
Oh, and there's so many wonderful perennials out there. Any of your favorites on my list?
Oh, for sure. Asters. I love asters. And iris, of course. Any kind of lavender. Hostas, because I've got lots of trees and they just, you know, they work under there with ferns.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Phlox.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Phlox people don't tend to think are adaptable, but there are so many choices within the whole family of phlox that you can get everything from low woodland plants to tall garden phlox. The peacock series, the white of the peacock series, I honestly cannot believe how adaptable that one has been. It went from full sun to full shade, and I lost a few of the plants, but no mildew and beautiful clear flowers, the whole thing. So they are a bit more adaptable than we give them credit to. Phlox are known for powdery mildew on the leaves, so there are some
out there that are not quite as good. Jenna comes out, it's spelled like Jean A. Jenna is a fantastic one across the board. Trial gardens and in settings that I've planted, it does beautifully. Nikki is another one that does beautifully, and great color. There are plenty out there for you to choose from, and they'll tolerate a little bit of excess moisture. So if we get tough rains or if they get a minor flooding, they won't go belly up instantaneously, but you don't want them to be in standing water. That is for sure. Another in the perennial range, I put a few grass or grass-like plants in there. Carex is a wonderful, wonderful plant that has really been coming strong in the market for the last 5 years. And there are a number of carex out there that will be just great no matter where you put them. There are also some that love a little bit more lowland. And, you know, just think of what you see when you're out wandering around native areas. Those things that look like grasses are probably sedges. And, you know, we've all heard these sedges have edges. So when in doubt, run your fingers, you know, run it between your thumb and your finger, and you'll feel if it feels a little sharp, it's probably a sedge and not a grass. But those can be extremely adaptable, especially the lowland ones, because they're used to that periodic flooding. And so when we look at adaptability, you love the lavenders. Lavenders are not known for liking moisture on their crowns, which is often why we get a lot of death over winter when we've got wet, heavy snow sitting on lavender. They don't like that moisture on the crown, but they do adapt wonderfully to dry weather. So if, you know, think Mediterranean, think limestone, think dry. And if you have a site that does experience that dryness in July, August, then that might be a really good plant for you.
Yes, I have. Well, there are two plants planted together because I wasn't sure if either would survive, and they both did. And I'm actually going to have to break them up this year because they're getting so big. So I've been very happy with that. It's right by my front door too, so it smells wonderful. Oh, yeah, I'm so happy
What a treat, right?
Yes,
what a treat.
For sure.
Another one that does really well in a bunch of different sites are hellebores.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, for an early spring flower, it can't be beat. And you can move those a little bit, and you can pull them apart a little bit, but they actually look best when you leave them alone for a long period of time, because then they get almost shrub-like. You know, they'll be like 2 feet and absolutely fantastic. But they tolerate the winter snow as well as the summer heat, which is wonderful.
Do they prefer sunny part or shade?
Part and or shade.
Okay.
And it really depends on what your heat factor is on each individual site. When I go down south, though, the hellebores do much better when they're under afternoon sun protection. So almost any shade plant will do fine with morning light. It's that afternoon heat, light, et cetera, that will just make them go toes up.
Mm-hmm.
The hellebores, I've got some that are actually in full shade. They're a little slower to develop into large plants, but they're coming along just fine. And I have some in the sun that get west sun. They get a little beat up August, September or so, but they're really tough. Their roots are great. I would not, if you have them in full sun, I would not ignore them moisture-wise. So for a site that might get periodic flooding early fall, late in the summer, they may do okay there. Another one that does okay in flooding zones is actually Heikanakloa, which I didn't put on the list. It's a Japanese forest grass that really just does not like wet crown, but it likes moisture on its roots. And so for something that might get a lot of soil moisture, but not a lot of top water. That one does really well also, and that's a shade plant.
And you had talked about some of a native hibiscus. Is that the one you have on the list?
Yeah.
Swamp mm-hmm. rose? Mm-hmm.
It's Moscudos, so it's Hibiscus moscutus, and that is a big flowering native hibiscus. And those you can grow in standing water, and they will be fine. I've seen them actually at Ball Seed where they put them into the ponds and have them growing. So the big flowering will take an awful lot of moisture. They'll also take an upland setting also. So it's one that will just kind of swing whichever way you need it to go.
Yeah, and it's beautiful too. If you like those big tropical-looking blossoms, mm-hmm. they're gorgeous. Mm-hmm. So I just feel bad when you buy a patio hibiscus and then, you know, it's you can't keep it outside. It'll die.
No, so. And when you move them inside, they're aphid and scale magnets. And so what you bring in, you know, when they're outside, they do okay. And the native prey insects can kind of keep those under control a bit. But when you move them in the house, the light deficit stresses them out. And mm-hmm. then they're a little bit more susceptible to the insects. So that can be a problem. And this hibiscus, the native ones, much bigger flowers than the tropical here.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, they can be almost dinner plate size on some of the developed cultivars. The native will be about the size of a salad plate.
Okay, that's pretty big.
So really quite delightful. And there is some lovely breeding work being done on them and selection work to find those with different qualities on the flowers.
Okay.
And the plant structure itself. So upright, a little bit more out there. Some with an eye, some with clear, solid color. So they're coming. They're
wonderful.
Coming.
Our guest today is Liz Freemuth. She is a provider of concierge horticultural services through her business, The Garden Hoe. What gardening questions do you have? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Najoe. Join us again on Monday at 11. Bird expert Bill Volkert is back. And then at 12:30, we'll hear about the new movie with Wisconsin ties. It's called My Dead Friend Zoe. I saw the preview. It looks pretty darned good. So we'll be talking about that. But right now, we're talking with Liz Freemuth, and we're taking your gardening calls. And Liz can answer pretty much anything. So whatever's on your mind, 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can email talk@wpr.org. So, all right. So anything else on the perennial list that you wanted to highlight? I see you got Veronica on there.
Veronica. Yeah, well, that was actually a typo. It should be Vernonia. But Veronica, you know, now that you mentioned that, Veronica and Salvia are lovely plants. They're in the same family-ish. And they will tolerate an awful lot of heat. And so if you have a heat island somewhere, little microclimate in your yard, salvias are wonderful. Veronicas are wonderful for really just being troopers. They will need a little bit of water. So if you have a droughty area, you'll see some of the tips die back. You'll see some of the leaves die back, but they don't go away.
Mm-hmm.
The plants themselves do not go away, and
sure.
It doesn't weaken them tremendously. So there are wonderful, wonderful plants in that family. The autocorrect, which made it Veronica, I typed in Vernonia, and Vernonia is a beautiful native that you can get. The species will oftentimes get up to 7 feet tall. So we're talking about a really, really lovely big plant if you've got a wow spot. But so the breeding that has been done has also gotten them down to, you know, like about a 3 foot height. And some that look almost as if you sheared them, but you didn't. You can, but they bred them so that they just are beautiful mounds of purple flowers just very late in the season. You know, we're talking September, end of August, September. And they respond like asters and mums do. So you can cut them back in May and take them down pretty far to keep the height under control. So if somebody did put in a Vernonia thinking that they were going to have a nice controlled little plant and it's 6 feet tall, you can give it a couple of whacks. And about the same time you do mums and asters, and it does the same thing. You get extra branching and you get extra flowers on it. It will kick the flowering back a couple of weeks generally, but some of those that are lovely and controlled would be summer swan song, and then also iron cross is a little bit shorter, so you're looking at about 3 foot, 3 to 4 or 5 feet on those. But they're wonderful. They die back every year. The cleanup is so easy. You just kind of snap them off at the ground late spring, early to late spring, and you're done. Boom, there you go.
Nice. I like those kind of things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, the other ones that we don't typically expect to be really adaptable is, we kind of forget about it, too, is Helenium, which can be called sneezeweed. They're more in the yellow to reds colors, and they have that almost daisy-like, small, multiple petals, bigger head. Beautiful, beautiful breeding being done on that. That one is phenomenally tolerant of moist areas, and it will do fine in the heat. It's another one of those that you can cut off earlier in the season. Same time you do all of these. You go out, you do your asters, your Vernonia, your Helenium.
And what time would that be, Liz, because you didn't share that?
May.
Okay.
May. May. And what you're – thank you for reminding me.
Sure.
Yeah, I got to tell you when to do it. You can start as soon as the growth gets up to about 10 inches to a foot, then you want to start kind of cutting them back. If you're like me and go, oh, no, I forgot to do that, you can do it in June. You don't want to go past roughly the middle to the end of June. At this point in our state, when you get up a little bit further north, you can push that envelope a little bit more towards the 4th of July. But if you wait too long, then if we get cold weather early in the fall, you may lose the buds. But for the most part, these fall flowering are cold tolerant also. So it's not that we get a little bit of cool weather and they're going to go belly up. They don't. They survive well.
Yeah, some of the new colors on those Heleniums are amazingly beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are. And it's a plant that if you don't know you're looking for it, you aren't going to see it because it is not one of those super popular out in the garden centers, et cetera. It's got almost an aster-like stem on it for look, and so that can be kind of meh in the pot also.
Yeah.
Don't discount something that looks kind of meh in the pot as long as it looks healthy.
Right, exactly. We have a caller online here. Carol in Green Bay, what can we help you with?
Hi. I have a question about my hostas. I have a shady yard also, and so I have them in various spots. And in some of the areas, they were totally devastated by slugs. And I'm wondering if there's something I can do to treat those areas before the hostas get totally eaten up.
Have you used slug bait in the past?
No, I have not.
You can do that. You can use a slug bait. So you go to the garden center and look for a slug bait. The other thing you can do, if beer is something that is consumed in your house, then you can put out a small container of fresh beer in the evening, in the late afternoon evening. And what works best is to dig a little bit of an indentation that you can fit either, you know, like a mayonnaise jar lid or something like that, a tuna can, you know, something on that order. Although tuna can, you want to watch it really well so you don't get raccoons sniffing the tuna. But anyway, you bury that at ground level and put fresh beer in it every afternoon, evening. That yeast attracts the slugs, and they will die a happy death. So they go in there, and there you go. Diatomaceous earth also works on soft-bodied critters. Diatomaceous earth are critters that are crunched up. You cannot feel them with your hands. You don't. They will not cut your fingers. You do want to wear a mask. They're soft particles, very small particles, so you want to wear a mask when you're dumping it out, just to be on the safe side. But what happens is those soft-bodied critters crawl over the top of it, so you want to sprinkle that out underneath and around the plants, and as they crawl over them, it slices their bellies up and they die. And so it's kind of a, you know, satisfying slug death. But because the particles are small, you do have to put that on every day. So if it's, you know, once you get them under control, then you probably don't have to do it quite as often. But those particles sift down into the soil really easily, so you want to apply that daily.
We've had plenty of experts talk about the beer trap.
Mm-hmm.
And we did have a listener send a picture a few weeks back, and the little container was just packed with slugs. There wasn't room for another slug in there.
It's amazing how they love that beer. I mean, this is Wisconsin. Everybody loves their beer, so why would slugs be any different?
Apparently that doesn't work in any other state. No, I'm kidding. All right. Well, good luck, Carol. Try one of those, and hopefully you won't have that problem. It's so devastating when you see that all of your plant has been attacked by something or other. But, yeah.
It really is, because we put so much time and love into our gardens.
Yeah.
But we just learned to cohabitate, and that means you either kick them out or they win. It's up to you how you deal with that.
Exactly. So let's go on to annuals now. Because, you know, when you think about annuals, it's like, oh, it doesn't matter. They're only here for a year, so why should I care if they're adaptable or not? But that does help, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, we're talking about adaptability for in the ground. Containers with annuals in them, they need water. You know,
oh, yes.
They need water daily, sometimes multiple times throughout the day. So we're not talking about putting these into containers and then ignoring them for the rest of the year. But things that do okay in beds and will adapt really well, you know, I only have a handful in here, but the dichondra is one that, and you'll see silver falls frequently. It's a very, very tiny leaves, and they're kind of silvery gray green and fuzzy. You know, they look a little fuzzy. They look fuzzier than they feel,
right?
That way. And they, I think the most beautiful display, in ground display I saw was down at University of Georgia Athens in their trial garden. They had a bed of it that flowed, so it was a tiered, and these plants flowed all the way down. They had them planted on each tier, and it just looked like Silver Falls was supposed to look. You put that outside, and it is extremely tolerant. It will take a bit of shade. It will take full sun. It will take everything in between. And that one you can clip back, and it continues to branch out and to grow. The same thing with sweet potatoes. Sweet potato vines, which is Apamea batatas, so many different colors, so many different types, so many different habits, but they are extremely tolerant also. Very, very tolerant.
Until it gets cold.
Until it gets cold. Hence the annual, right?
Yes. I've had those before. They're like the first thing to die, I swear.
Oh, absolutely. All you have to do is breathe like an
yes.
ice cube breath on
yeah.
it, and they're done.
They're done.
But as far as conditions, moisture, sun, et cetera, they're fine. Another one is the New Guinea impatiens that if you don't use it outside in beds where you've got annual flowers, you should. The tolerance on it, it's fantastic. It will go full sun to full shade, full sun. It does need a little bit more moisture, but it's very tolerant.
All right. Well, it's time for us to take a break for the news. We will be back again after that with more wonderful advice from Liz Fremont. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
This is Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest is gardening expert Liz Fremont. She is a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Ho, and she's happy to help you with any of your gardening questions. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Liz, we had an email pertaining to our slugs discussion. Katie emailed to say that her mother used to use a half a grapefruit rind left over from breakfast. She put her beer for the slug control in the garden using that, and it's, of course, biodegradable. What a great idea.
That is a fantastic idea. I love what people come up with. It is so wonderful.
I do, too. Well, we had gotten to our annuals before we broke for news, and we talked about a couple of them. Do you have any more that you'd like to mention?
Well, I think that there's a lot of annuals out there that will tolerate many things, but geraniums, to not forget some of our old standards, they've been around forever for a reason. They do really, really well. And there are many plants. Calibrachoa is one that I did not put on the list. We know it as Million Bells. That as a landscape plant, that and wave petunias are very, very tolerant except for drought. And you will find that on most of the annuals, that they'll tolerate a little bit of, you know, maybe a little bit too much moisture as long as it's not standing. So if we get heavy rains and the soil is wet, they're usually fine. Most annuals, unless they are made for in water, are not going to respond extremely well. So my list on annuals is a little short because of that, and because I know that these will do okay. Violas are one, pansies, Johnny Jump-Ups, et cetera, that will tolerate almost anything you throw at them. You can put snow on top of them when they're flowering and they'll be fine. So there is a wide range of acceptance of conditions in violas, definitely. I had sedums in as an quote-unquote annual. We have so many good perennial sedums that it should be in the perennial list as well, because there are those that, you know, like the wider leafed sedums that look almost like cacti. Those are not hardy for us, but they do beautifully out in the landscape as an annual. So the pancake leaf type sedums, and those will do beautifully. They'll tolerate an awful lot of heat and dry before they go belly up. Too much moisture, not so much. So again, it's understanding which way do you need this plant to adapt. Mm-hmm. Some like Helenium will go both ways and do okay, from the perennial list. But annuals, that level is a little bit smaller.
And I was going to ask you about sedum, you know, like our taller fall-blooming ones like Autumn Joy. I always have a problem with them getting too lanky and falling over. Should we cut those down at some point?
Well, either that or you can go to some of the new breeding, which has gotten rid of the too tall and floppy habit that Autumn Joy will typically exhibit for 90% of the population out there. So there are an awful lot of wonderful sedums that are a little bit shorter. There's a Dazzle series that is maybe about 8 to 10 inches tall. And there's Dazzle Berry. There's a bunch of, I have found those to be extremely forgiving. And not only just forgiving, but they continue to thrive and flower and do really well. If you're looking for a sedum that has a flower stem so that you can cut it, because they do make great, the flowers on sedum make great cut flowers. So in that case, you know, if they get a little floppy, the ones that you already have in your yard, just say, okay, you know what? This is an opportunity for me to bring cut flowers in the house, and cut them off, pop them in a vase, and they stay for quite a while. But when you're looking at replacing, then look at something that, if you like the habit and it does well in your yard of Autumn Joy, pick something that it comes from that breeding line. And there is a fantastic sedum grower just over the border in Hebron, Illinois. His name is Brent Horvath, and his company is called Intrinsic Perennials. And he does a wonderful job of selecting either plants from other breeders or selecting and breeding his own. And he is even has a book out on sedums. Wonderful guy, lovely, lovely man. Beautiful nursery. It is a wholesale nursery, so it's not open to the public. But if you go to your local garden center, if you look at their website, find something that you like, go to your local garden center and see if they can't order them for you.
Oh, that he might be a good person to have on Garden Talk and talk about
sedums. Yeah, he is fantastic. His book is lovely. It was published by Kew Gardens, I believe, and it is a really, really good book on sedums, and he is extremely knowledgeable on them. Lovely, lovely person. And, you know, I find that a lot in the plant world. A lot of the plant breeders, we plant people are strange. And that's okay, because most of the time we're really nice, too.
Yes.
So it's lovely when you have someone who is doing great breeding on plants and then is also a lovely person.
Oh, that's a wonderful combination. We got an email from Aaron in Hartford to say that there are pencil size holes in a perfect line going around the circumference of what he believes is a crab apple tree. And he's wondering if it's the work of woodpeckers and how worried should he be? And is there anything that can be done to prevent it? Again, that's a little outside your area of expertise, but I bet you've run into woodpeckers before.
Oh, you betcha. And the holes themselves, it would really kind of tell me whether it is a woodpecker or, you know, what we are looking at this year also are the remnants, the leftover holes from our cicada last year. So he's probably outside of the cicada range. So that leads me to woodpeckers. Mm-hmm. And what woodpeckers are doing is they are identifying for you where those insects are in that plant, in that tree. So if, and I know when I go out and I look and my pine tree has a bunch of woodpecker holes in it, it's like, ooh, I had better get the spray guy out here to give my tree a treatment because there's something going on. So they're looking for food. And how do you control for woodpeckers? That's very specific, because they are protected for the most part. If it's a red-headed woodpecker, they're protected. So you cannot trap them and kill them. And so you want to exclude them. And oftentimes what works really, really well is a fake owl. You know, and you can get them at the garden centers. You can get them online. But we're encouraging go to our small businesses. So, you know, please do that. Our owls that you can place, and they are predators of the woodpeckers. So woodpeckers can be scared off by that.
Ah, well, that's an option for sure. But if they're there, more than likely, you said there's insects somewhere.
There's insects.
So get it checked out. So
get it checked out. And if any homeowner does not have a relationship with a tree care professional, certified arborist, et cetera, that's something that you need to develop like you would a relationship with your health care provider. Because you want somebody coming in and looking at your trees once a year and saying, what do I need to do? What's the level of importance? And you don't want to be caught behind the eight ball on this. So develop a relationship before you need it. You know, if you have a tree, you probably need an arborist at some point. And in this case, yes, it would be if you've got holes, you've got woodpeckers. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah, he did send a picture, which I just received here, and there are, oh my gosh, so many holes, and they're all on the line going straight up. It kind of looks like me trying to find a 2x4 in my wall. I didn't know where it was. But we're talking about, you know, 15 to 10 holes, you know, and they're really close together, and it's going all the way around, but
How big are the holes?
It's
hard to tell.
They look fairly small.
Does it look as though they're somewhat connected?
Yes.
That to me says cicada damage.
Oh.
And with the 17 year cicadas last year, that if he was in a region that gets cicadas, we will see an awful lot of that this year. And you really can't do anything about it. What the cicadas do is they land on an appropriate branch for them, and they lay their eggs in a line. And it almost looks, once those holes heal over, it almost looks like they're like a line of holes. And the insects are already gone. So the eggs are laid, the larvae drop, they burrow down. 17 years later, they come out and they're here again. You will see some damage from those eggs, you know, from where they were laid, from those sites. But unless it's a branch that was fairly thin, I don't expect a lot of damage. I don't expect a lot of breakage. And what we get is sometimes if it's a smaller branch, just that process of laying the eggs in there and those coming out will weaken that branch enough that a good strong wind will break it off.
And this is the actual trunk of the tree.
Trunk?
Yeah.
And if it's a trunk of the tree, especially if it's cicada damage, and they typically will go for something that's a little bit softer. So it may not be what we're talking, you know, what his mm-hmm. experience is right now. But for those out there that will have this, and they will, if you had cicadas anywhere around, you will see this on your plant material, that really the branches can break and fall off, or it can cause enough destruction of the internal system that the end of the branch just ceases to function well. And that branch will die off, or you'll mm-hmm. have to cut it off. Most of the time, cicadas laying eggs do not kill a plant, not unless it's a young plant and it's a main trunk and that tissue is soft enough for them to go in and lay their eggs, or desirable enough for them to lay their eggs. Is that going to be a problem? Now, when you're talking about a diameter of an inch or two, I don't know that you're going to see an awful lot. If it was a lot of eggs, that may weaken it enough that a good stiff wind will break it off. But they don't do anything to the health of it other than branch breaking.
Yeah, looking at this picture, he said it goes all the way around. I would think that it's definitely susceptible to wind coming through.
To breakage.
But, mm-hmm. you know, here's a thought, Erin, is that you can send that picture to PJ Leash at the entomology lab at UW, and he'll probably be able to tell you right away if it is cicadas or something else. So that would be mm-hmm. my suggestion. So
anytime you have holes going like that in a very distinct pattern, it is going to be insect related at some point, whether mm-hmm. those insects are in the interior or whether they were on the outside poking it in, one or the other.
Jeff and Barry Mills called to suggest that it is caused by a yellow-bellied sapsucker, which they do also, but there's so much of it, I can't see a little bird doing that, but who knows? It'll be interesting to find out.
You know, you do need to check anytime you think that it is a bird or an animal. I mean, woodchucks are protected. Woodpeckers are protected. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to violate federal law to control a critter. And if you're not comfortable with any type of critter control, whether it's insect, animal, bird, whatever it is, call a wildlife specialist and have them come in and help you. An arborist, if it's a tree, you know, take advantage of the UW labs because they're fabulous, and get some help.
Okay, sounds good. We had another email from Merritt in Wausau. They had cut down their ash trees last year, and now they're looking to fill in the space with some small, fast-growing tree. It's part sun to full sun. Any suggestions, Liz?
I don't know what the conditions are mm-hmm. up there. And I would say take a look at – there's a couple of ways to approach this. There are wonderful, lovely trees. As I had said before, I love the fringe tree It's a smaller tree. It's not particularly fast growing. It can be a single stem or it can be a multi-stem depending on what kind you buy, but that is a really good tree. Another one that I love and will grow up by Wausau is a Heptacodium. The Heptacodium is not a native, but it has beautiful habit, and it's called Seven Sunflower Tree.
Oh, sure.
And
mm-hmm.
It doesn't flower until August, the end of July or August, and it has beautiful flowers. They smell a bit like honey. And then that's followed by what people typically think are the flowers, but it's the fruit. It's a maroon, fuzzy fruit. And most of the tree has got seven branches, you know, seven stems on the flowers, seven stems on the branches, hence the seven suns. There's also historically a story about that it was at a time in China when it was the seventh son of, you know, it goes on.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It is an original, the plant is from China. It was from the Yangtze River area, I believe. And they have these seeds, they have dated them back 3 million years. And they've gone from upland to lowland to all over. I don't find them invasive here. It can get to be about 15 to 20 feet tall. I find them to be extremely tolerant. I have them in shade, full sun, wet area, dry area, and they do just like it. The bark is reminiscent of more trees that you find down south, like a crepe myrtle. So it's got a very pale bark, and it does get striations on it that are beautiful. They can be in blues and greens. Otherwise, it's kind of a paley blonde wood sort of color, and the bark slightly exfoliating, can be a bit messy to trim, but you know, if you leave them alone, they're just fine also. So that's one that he could definitely use. There are some maples that would do wonderfully there that are smaller in structure as well. Magnolias, we're getting close to the outside range, but we do have quite a few that are four that are good in zone four, so we might find something there. If it's a wet area, you may try willows, a salix of some sort. Always oaks. You know, there are smaller selections of oaks also.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and we can't forget the musselwoods. The musselwood,
oh,
which
I
is on my
do.
List. Yeah, and it is one of the most adaptable trees out there. So that, and you know, junipers are not going to get probably wide enough unless it's a really wide selection. So if he wants cover, you know, and something fast growing, I typically think people want cover quickly. So you're looking at, you know, maybe a multi-stem sort of plant.
Mm-hmm. Musselwood has a really interesting outside the bark area, isn't it? It's
mm-hmm.
very distinctive.
Yep.
I think a lot of times we forget about what it looks like when all the leaves are off.
It's such an interesting tree. It's got it's gnarly
mm-hmm.
In a very good way. And I don't mean surfer dude gnarly. I mean, it's very, very knobby and gnarly and looks like muscle. And it is a tree that family actually responds very well. The Carpinus respond very well to pruning. So if you want something that you can hedge or pleach, look them up. That it's PLEACH. Unless you're in England, then it's PLEECH. it is a way of making walls out of trees. And those and beech actually respond very, very well to pruning. So if it's an area where you can do something like that or you're looking for hedging, it is a tree that you can start working on as it grows. It's not a particularly fast-growing tree, but it's not as slow as a beech either.
Mm-hmm. It's got a very pretty flower on it too, doesn't it?
It does, and the leaves are fantastic.
Uh-huh. Yeah, very nice, very nice. Mm-hmm. Kind of does have that beech, birchy kind of look to it. So,
It does. It does, and it's often called, you know, a blue beech, more in the ironwood kind of area also.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the last few minutes here, Liz, you just have an encyclopedic knowledge of plants. How do you keep up on what's new? What do you do to find all these wonderful cultivars?
I just go where every shiny object is blinking around. I go to a lot of trial gardens. And the reason why I do that, no matter where I go, when I'm traveling, whether it's for work or for fun, I look to see what trial gardens and what public gardens are out there. And I do a run through at different times of the year. And it's just amazing. I mean, trial gardens, whether it's in Madison or whether it's in Texas or, you know, Georgia, wherever it happens to be, they're going to do side by side on these plants. So not only do you see what's new, because we can go online and you can type in new plants for 2025. That's going to give you something to start with. But how do those plants actually grow? How are they consistent from plant to plant? So that's what I do. That, and then I talk to people. I talk to professionals. I talk to the people who are doing the breeding. I wander around their sales yards. I, you know, tap people on the shoulder and annoy the dickens out of them asking questions. But that's really, I mean, that's how we learn, mm-hmm. you know. And so for me, the first step for anybody is go to botanic gardens, go to trial gardens, and take a look. As you can get blocks of one plant. So you can see that, oh, plant A in a block of six or eight, every single one is consistently beautiful. You go to plant B, and there might be two or three out of that block of six or eight that look good. So doing that helps you increase your chances of success.
And do we have some in Wisconsin that you, I know UW-Madison area has some, right?
Yep, and Berner Botanic also does beautiful trial gardens. And then also go to some of the, when you're at the greenhouses, them if they have a trial area. So we had mentioned Ebert's before and Jung's. They are going to have areas that they're trialing stuff somewhere, and ask them if they share that with the public, or if you can take a look at what they're working on. And that is a good way also. A lot of the plant breeders, mainly in the wholesale realm, are going to be developing plants here and there also. But most plant people are happy to talk about what they're working on and happy to say, hey, look what's coming out in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good resource. And is there like a spot you can go to look for these areas? Clearinghouse, so to say.
Google machine it and put in trial gardens near me.
Okay.
You will find them. And I do that no matter where I am. So they're great. Trial gardens up in Minnesota. There are mm-hmm. great trial gardens.
Okay, well.
I think that's one of my top choices.
And what was the last one? Because you did cut out again.
Oh, Iowa, Minnesota, mm-hmm. Illinois. I mean, you can go down to Champaign, Urbana if you're down in that area. Purdue has got great trial gardens also. So if you check a lot of universities, mm-hmm. they will have either a trial garden or someplace close. Michigan does a great tour in August, usually, and it's a combination of trial gardens at universities and then botanic gardens and also growers.
Okay. Well, Liz, thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge with us. We really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll have you back again soon.
Oh, thank you so much, and thanks, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye. Our guest has been Liz Fremont. She is a provider of concierge horticulture services through her business, The Garden Hoe. Up next, we'll listen to a conversation that Larry had about the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. So stay with us.
Well, roses are a beautiful addition to almost any garden, but some varieties can be difficult to grow. And up next, we're going to be talking about work that's being done to make roses more sustainable. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk, and great to have David Zlizak back to talk with us. He's a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Science Department at UW River Falls, is involved in the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. And we're going to find out more about it. David Zlizak, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be back with you and the listeners.
You are involved in the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. Tell us about that program.
Yeah, I'd love to. So it's short. or the short name is ARTS, the ARTS program, to make it simpler. So in 2012, the All-America Rose Selection Program, which used to be the premier national trial, disbanded. It started in 1938, and it was industry-led, and roses were trialed across the country, and winner takes all, the best above average rose everywhere is what a lot of marketing dollars was put behind. And a number of colleagues and I have been running low maintenance rose trials as part of the Earthkind program, seeing what roses are regionally adapted to local pest, disease, climate factors. And so with the disbanding of All-America Rose Selection and them maybe being a little slow to the gate in terms of not spraying their test roses with fungicides early enough, because people want low maintenance roses, some of the last winners weren't necessarily the healthiest, and their impact in the marketplace began to decline. So a number of us already doing low maintenance sustainable rose trials recognize that there is this need, and we took core components of our more extensive scientific long-term trialing process and created a shorter term 2-year trial, and have trial sites across the country. And instead of a winner take all approach, which doesn't make sense because the same plant doesn't do well everywhere with all the different crops that we love to grow, that we have regional awards. And the regions that we use for the roses is what ecologists use, a Köppen climate system, which takes into account not only temperature, but precipitation, which is important for a lot of the diseases and insects and those pressures. So we use a Köppen climate system that a lot of gardeners may be less familiar with than the USDA cold hardiness zones, but it's more representative, it's more informative than the USDA cold hardiness zones. So we have regional award-winning roses, and the message ultimately is these roses were grown without preventative fungicides, insecticides. They were monitored monthly throughout the growing season for 2 years, and they're compared with market standards. So we know year by year the climate can be different. We're getting a lot of rain this year. So we always plant 2 leading market standard roses, Double Knockout and Sunrise Sunset, and any trial rose that scores equal or better at the end of the 2-year process earns an award. And so homeowners, landscapers can have confidence that given basic plant care, these roses should be highly likely to be successful in our gardens.
Well, it seems like a great way to go about it. And we have the zones or sites here. We have a couple of zones, I guess you could call it. I hate to use the term zone. I don't think you're using zone as a term, but maybe you are.
So instead of a zone like the USDA cold hardiness zone, these are climatic regions.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. I could share a tiny bit about zones for comparing and contrasting, and there's no one metric that totally encompasses everything that we need to know as gardeners. Will a plant grow well here or not? But the cold hardiness zone map has been useful for us because cold is often a major factor that leads to plant injury. But I'd love for people to think about plant injury over winter from this perspective. As we go from August to September to October, plants harden off. And what does that mean? That means that they're able to tolerate colder and colder temperatures before they're injured. And then plants are able to tolerate the coldest temperature throughout the year, typically in mid-January. That's when they're the most hardened off. And then they begin to deacclimate, tolerating warmer and warmer temperatures before this injury until spring. So we have this curve at which what's the minimum temperature that they could still survive. It gets lower and lower to mid-January, and then they come back out. Anytime the actual temperature falls below that curve, we have plant injury. And we could have a lot of plant injury in the fall and in the spring with temperatures that aren't super cold from our perspective, but they fall below what the plant can tolerate. So with, you know, climatic up and downs that we're experiencing, especially in the fall and the spring, that could be when our plants get the most injury, actually. We ultimately, for our region, need plants that go to bed early, sleep soundly, and wake up late. So that's at least my perspective towards cold hardiness. I take less stock in them than other people. But the Köppen climate system, which takes into account not only temperature, but also moisture, is really important. Climate specialists, conservationists have used it for years, knowing that those factors impact disease and insect pressure too.
Well, according to the maps on the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program, the website, which I think is a good one, and if you're interested in roses, you ought to be paying attention to the site. We have Wisconsin divided into the humid, cool summer group and the humid, hot summer group. And I think the humid, cold summer group, does that take up the most? Yeah, that takes up, I think, about three quarters of the state almost.
Yeah, yeah, the northern three quarters, and that's where I live. And then the southern quarter, Milwaukee through about the Madison area, it looks like, and then west to, you know, Platteville and the southwest region is the a bit warmer summer group, yeah.
And you used... You kind of use the zones in a way. You use temperature and you used humidity in coming up with these groups.
The climate specialists have. So this system's been in place for over 100 years, the Köppen climate system. So we're not recreating the wheel. We're just leveraging what others that went before us have created.
And the trials take place. I was looking at Wisconsin. There are trials taking place. Talk about where they are taking place.
Yeah, great question. So we're grateful for botanical gardens, arboretums, extension offices, with horticulture extension agents that host these trials. So after All America Rose Selection disbanded, they had high entry fees and a big marketing push that cost a lot of money. A lot of the nurseries felt kind of burned and they didn't have as much money anymore to invest in things like that. So our work is basically on a shoestring budget. So we have very modest entry fees because we want all the nurseries that want to enter their roses to enter them. And we leverage the generosity of wonderful volunteers, additional volunteers. I'm a volunteer. I'm the president right now of Arts to make these trials possible. So we have a trial site at Green Bay Botanical Garden, as well as Berner Botanical Garden. And these two sites, we get new entries every year, but the plants are followed through for 2 years. So they don't have enough space to house simultaneous trials, one set of roses in year one, the other in year two. So they're sister gardens. So they leapfrog every other year. They take the set of roses, but they represent our Wisconsin area. And then there's additional trial sites in South Dakota at Brookings, University of Minnesota and Crookston area used to host a site years ago, and then Moorhead area. So Ryman Gardens at Iowa State University hosts a site, Chicago Botanic Gardens, which might be closer to some of the listeners that live in southern Wisconsin to come and visit. They're a trial site too, but that's for the DFA or the southern quarter of the state, that region, the Chicago Botanic Gardens. So we have trial sites and partners across the country. Our goal is to ultimately have two trial sites at least in each of the different Köppen climate regions. And there's about eight or nine throughout the U.S. Some are larger than others, but and we're working towards that goal. Many of the regions are already there.
Our guest today, David Zlezak, is a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Sciences Department at UW River Falls, telling us about the American Rose Trials for Sustainability Program, or ARTS is a nice acronym for sure. Great to have him with us today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News.
You come to WPR News for trustworthy reporting, thought-provoking conversations, and laugh-out-loud entertainment. Thank you to the tens of thousands of donors who provide the largest source of support for WPR programs.
The largest source of funding for the WPR programs you enjoy comes from tens of thousands of individuals and families who contribute. You can hear your favorite program and discover new ones thanks to member support. Find out more at WPR.org.
Right now, we're talking with David Zlezak, who is a professor of horticulture in the Plant and Earth Science Department at UW River Falls. We've been zeroing in on the American Rose Trials for Sustainability program, or the ARTS program. Veronica emails wondering what kind of fertilizer she should be giving her roses. They don't seem to get very big, and they look kind of spindly.
Oh, that's a great question, Veronica. Maybe before we brainstorm that question, I just love to leave people with the idea. If you go to the website, the ARTS website, there's a shorter URL that gets you there, just trustedroses.org. And one of the top links that you could click on is the map. And then you can see which region that you're in, and then click on the square to the left associated with that region. And you can see a list of all the winning roses for your region. So that's a really easy, nice resource to go to. So for fertilizer, what I love to do, and I'll share a quick little story, is always starting with a soil test is really wise. Maybe about 30 years ago when I was in college, moved the roses. My family, my parents moved when I was in college, and I dug up the garden and moved it. And after a couple years, the roses just weren't growing as well at the new place. And I was, you know, throwing fertilizer at well-balanced fertilizers, everything. And they were still, you know, kind of suffering. And then I broke down and mailed in a soil sample, and all I needed was potassium. And I put some muriate of potash down, and things were fine. So I know sometimes it's you know, people just want a quick fix and just do something and have it over with, but just a quick soil test and knowing what your soil has, what you need, would be really helpful.
And it also, when you send in the soil test, you can say, well, I'm growing roses on this property or whatever you're growing.
Yeah. And then they'll make the recommendation targeted for the crop. That's amazing. Yeah, so what we'll always need to, or it's helpful to add some nitrogen, because a nitrogen cycle, it goes through the system. So personally, because I have oodles of roses at home. Wait, I don't even know how many I have. I have thousands of roses, 2 acres of roses. I have a limited budget. So I use just 10-10-10, just cheaper regular garden fertilizer. I've had a soil test done when I first moved in to my current place a few years ago. I should have one again. But then I just use that just to keep things going. But you know, if you add a balanced fertilizer just to get things through if they're suffering a little bit right now, and then have that soil test done and make your corrections in response to the recommendations, that would be a good approach.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we've had a lot of rain recently, and what kinds of issues come up with roses during these sorts of conditions, and what can we do to keep them healthy?
Yeah, great question. So some of the fungal diseases tend to take off, and the roses that are more susceptible tend to defoliate more. So rose black spot, I'm excited to have some funding with the American Rose Society this summer to continue some of the work that myself and colleagues at University of Minnesota have been doing with identifying black spot resistance genes in roses so breeders can more strategically accumulate multiple genes in single plants. So rose black spot needs 6 to 8 hours of free moisture, which we can get with these rainstorms, dew at night, for the spores to penetrate and take hold. So rose black spot is out there. I've had some downy mildew this spring, which it's not a true fungus. It's a Oomycete or water mold. And when it's cool and wet, that could take off a little bit. So some above average fungal diseases, but with all the moisture, plants are growing real strong, which is great to see compared to years past with the drought. So even though there's some disease building a bit, it's just great to see plants really growing quick and being happy again.
Yeah, for sure. As you look at the areas that we have here, the hot summer, the humid hot summer group, and the humid, cool summer group. Do you have some, maybe take a look at some of your favorite roses from those areas and talk about those roses and in those conditions?
Yeah, that's a great question. So myself, I grew up in the Milwaukee area, and when I was a kid, I loved gardening and science, and Will Rattler, who's a breeder of the knockout roses when I was 13, I wrote to him and he wrote back to me and got me started breeding roses. At that point, I thought, you know, I could grow anything. The big, gorgeous hybrid tea roses, I'll spray them, I'll insulate them for winter. And then when they still got disease and I still lost some from winter, I realized sustainable roses are important. And so over the years here, the good, hardy, faithful roses that tend to hold up in old farm sites and places especially still capture my attention. Some of those faithful ones are Thérèse Bounet, which came out in the 1950s, hardy to the tip through most all the state. It has a little bit of our native Rosa Blanda in it, fragrant, red-tinted canes during the winter, just like our native Rosa Blanda. So that's a good one. Frau Dagmar Hestrop, the older Gosa, beautiful mounded plant habit, healthy foliage, big hips, big single, soft pink blooms. Those are faithful ones. A lot of the Agriculture Canada roses bred by Dr. Felicitas Sveda, named after North American explorers, many of those are still holding up and in doing well. I've been breeding roses mainly in a limited capacity over the years just at home, and a lot of my breeding is to create interesting hybrids and bring unique genetics together for the pathology work that I do. But one of those seedlings that came out above and beyond is basically like a explorer climber, but in an apricot kind of orange colored bud. So it brings warm colors into a big hardy, cane hardy climber like a William Baffin, which is pink. There's some wonderful newer roses. So through Bailey's Oscar Peterson, which was bred up in Morden, Manitoba, it won an arts award. Is a good faithful rose that's a creamy white and lots of buds, pretty winter hardy, maybe a little bit of powdery mildew at times, but not bad. Otherwise, very healthy. Campfire, beautiful range of colors. It's also from Agriculture Canada and Morden, Manitoba. So those are just a few of the many that I just adore.
So when you say you're doing this at home under limited conditions, what does it take to get in? You know, what do you do when in this whole process of breeding?
Yeah, great question. So I make control crosses. I collect anthers before they release their pollen and store them in little film canisters, let them dry. And then I cap them and freeze them. I could store them for over a year that way. And then I'll pull out the little capsules with who I want to be the daddy for the day and go out there and emasculate some of the female blooms and put the pollen of who I want to be the dad and mark them. I have lots of plant stands in my walkout basement. So I start lots of new seedlings every spring and get them planted out in the garden and just see what they do. You have these families of seedlings and everyone's different, even though they're full siblings, just like our families. And then I learn about them and see which ones inherited more disease resistance, more hardiness, different colors. I'm more concerned about a hardy, healthy plant first, and then hopefully see if they're pretty after that. But so I have a lot of hardy monsters at home that maybe mediocre for floral quality.
But but this process isn't just 1 year. This must take some time, you know, to develop.
Yeah, it's a way of life. I've been breeding roses for over 35 years now, so it's always fun. I just keep learning, and then eventually there's something unique, and with colleagues we try to figure out, okay, this rose has unique disease resistance. What's up with that? What genes are behind that? So it makes it really rewarding and fun.
And your whole, I want to go back and make sure that people are familiar with this American Rose Trials for Sustainability program. Again, this is something that I think is really valuable for anybody who's interested in growing roses. So go over again what people can get from this.
Yeah, great question. So ultimately, our goal is to provide recommendations of roses that do well in each of the regions based on objective scientific data collection. So the trials are open to, you know, any breeder nursery to enter their roses, and how awards are given is really straightforward and transparent. If the entry score is equal or greater than the average of our two trial market standard roses that are planted in every planting, Double Knockout and Sunrise Sunset, it earns an award. So the goal then is, you know, with basic plant care, you'll be highly likely to be successful with these roses. And if no rose meets that standard this year, none win for that region. If five of them win, great, they all get awards. So it's fair for all the nurseries, and any deserving rose is honored.
And is there a way for people to identify? I mean, they go to trustedroses.org, and they'll find the roses.
Yeah. Yep. So with all these different nurseries and their branding programs and what they want to have on their labels and tags, we share with them a logo that they could put on their tags. A lot of them don't, because they have their own marketing or they don't want to, you know, take extra space, and not every rose is a winner. So they don't want to, oh, well, people will see, well, this one's not a winner, but we still want to sell it. So the best thing to do is just go to our website and see what varieties are the best for your region and look for them.
And why the heck do roses have thorns? Dennis wants to know.
That's a great question. The rabbits chew right through them sometimes, don't they? And the deer, so they're not 100% effective. I don't know.
Well, they probably grew that way so that the rabbits couldn't get at them so much. But David, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you so much, and we'll visit again. Thank you, David. David Zlizak, Professor of Horticulture in the Plant and Earth Sciences Department at UW River Falls. Thanks to him, and thanks to our whole team, producers Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. For Garden Talk, on WPR News. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store.